I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This week is the launch of our season 18, kind of our in-between season, where we're just taking every week to bring on special guests that work in the criminal justice field, to do any educational content we can do, just to help us all be better informed and better able to do our jobs as criminal justice warriors as time goes on in our upcoming seasons. I know I told you guys in this week's follow-up episode that the plan for this week was as I was going to go through the custodial interviews and Miranda and all that case law. But I got into a conversation with a very talented lawyer that's worked on a bunch of cases that we're familiar with, including the Delphi case. And we got to talking about the question that had come up in this week's follow-up about conviction integrity units and how they work. And Michael happens to be an expert in that. I'll call you an expert, more expert than me. So without any further ado, I want to introduce, and anybody that follows Bob Mata is already aware of this guy, knows who he is, Mr. Michael Osbrook. And Mike, I'll let you introduce yourself and share your background a little bit with everybody.
So I'm a habeas lawyer. For the last 15 years, I've been doing mostly federal habeas cases from state convictions. There are also habeas cases from federal convictions, but I don't do many of those. And for 10 of the last 15 years, I just stopped about a year ago, taught a clinic at the Morris School of Law here in Bloomington at the university, in which the students and I litigated federal habeas cases, and we had pretty terrific success.
That's great. So was that like an innocence clinic, like some of the innocence projects?
It was not an innocence clinic. We also took on people who were serving undeserved extra decades in prison. It was about spotting cases. Habeas cases are extremely hard to win because the standard of review is such that they're very hard to win. Basically, as long as what the state courts did was reasonable, it's kind of over. Federal courts aren't interested. Can't be interested by statute.
Right. Well, great. Well, the first thing I want to get into, and we'll kind of see where the conversation goes, but as you heard, you got a little sneak peek at Friday's episodes. We're recording this on Wednesday. We had recorded the follow-up on Monday. Michael's seen it. You guys won't be hearing it until Friday, which is 2 days from now, so we're in our little Truth and Justice time machine now, so we're talking 2 days after everybody's heard that episode. But in that episode, somebody had a great question asking about conviction integrity units and how they work, and I had talked a little bit about my experiences working, I've worked cases that have been involved with the Dallas Conviction Integrity Unit, the Harris County, which is Houston Conviction Integrity Unit. And most recently, I've been working with the Michigan Attorney General's Conviction Integrity Unit and talked a little bit about what that process is like and how it goes. Well, Michael is an attorney in Indiana, which happens to be where Chris Bynum's case is at. And, he's going to come on and put his professor hat on and tell us a little bit about how that process works.
Well, as far as I know, there's only one conviction integrity unit in Indiana. There may be others, but I only know about the Marion County Conviction Integrity Unit, and that's Indianapolis. Otherwise, you have to work with the local prosecutors. There's no central conviction integrity unit. And we are, in Chris Bynum's case now, working with prosecutors in Lake County, which is where Gary is up north. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at the case. There are things that we've asked them to do, and I assume they're doing them. And so there really is no well-developed conviction integrity operation in Indiana.
Okay. And I'm sorry, you mentioned Bynum's case, and this is, I'm already derailing what you're doing, and I'll let you come right back to it. But it just reminded me that after listening to that episode, I had talked about a listener had asked questions about the metadata on the Matthews confession, and I was unable to find it, but you were able to pull it. And it's not that it's a huge deal, but we did find some information out that we wanted to, that I want to make sure everybody's aware of, that we actually do know at least when it was recorded compared to when the affidavit was written now.
It seems like the recording was done the day after the affidavit.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was what the affidavit was notarized on July 26th. And the metadata on the video was July 27th. So do with that what you will, but at least we know that according to the date put on the notarization and the date, the stamp on the video, that those two things were done a day apart, which for me kind of makes me, kind of confirms my theory. That doesn't confirm my theory, but I guess it adds weight to my theory that the video was done as an afterthought and perhaps as like kind of a lip sync.
Or it could have been, I mean, lip sync, or if it was read, it was not read, obviously, from the handwritten affidavit. There's no way he could have read that from a distance looking at it. In order to read it, it would have had to have been printed.
And on something bigger, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's a mystery. One thing, so I think Exhibit 1C in Fran's case was the phone itself, and it was a Motorola, and the metadata also says Moto on it. So I think that's a Motorola. You know, the question arises, was the video actually done on that on that phone that showed up?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of looks like it does. It also says the rotation is 270. So that's the camera turned on its side to the right, I think. Or no, it's with the back of the phone. It's the phone turned on its side to the left.
Yeah, because that was before the front-facing cameras and the iPhones that we know now.
Right. Otherwise, some of the other metadata is messed up. You know, it shows when I think it was copied to my computer and the last time I looked at it. But there's definitely a July 27th, 2014 date on the time the video was created. And it's also the last time it was modified.
Yeah, and Kathy had in our YouTube chat our patrons had just asked if it could have been recorded right after midnight. I believe the timestamp was like 9 p.m. on the 27th, if I'm remembering correctly.
9:17 is my recollection.
Yeah, about then. So yeah, it was in the evening the next day. So definitely, you know, close to, you know, at least over 12 hours, probably closer to 24 hours. We don't know what time the notary was done. But anyway, I don't want to dig too deeply into that anymore while we have you here. So I'll let you kind of pick back up about how this whole habeas process works in Indiana. And so you do all federal, or do you do any of the state habeas work too?
So because they're so intertwined, I spend a lot of my time setting cases up for federal court. So that involves getting involved in the state court
mm-hmm.
goings on. And, you know, to give you an example, there was a case that Fran Watson and I worked on. She was terrific. And it wasn't a guy who was innocent. It was a guy who had done something pretty awful at the age of 19. And then while he was out on bond, he'd been accused of doing something else. So what would have been a 30-year sentence, which in those days would have meant 15 real years, turned into a 90-year sentence. And then 24 years later, it turned out that he didn't do that thing while he was out on bond. And he actually, on his own from prison, got that arrest expunged.
On his own, he did that?
On his own. Mm-hmm. There are some really, I don't know if your audience knows, there are some really smart jailhouse lawyers out there.
Yeah, we've had a few of the, you know, the subjects of our show that have kind of worked as they've been the jailhouse lawyer, or they work with them. I know Jesse Eldred down in Texas always talks about the jailhouse, where they're not lawyers, but they're people that are so well versed in everything that help people write writs and do pro se motions and things like that all the time.
Well, the one actual exoneration I've been involved in, an awful lot of the important work was done by Dwayne Dunn alone.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing that your audience ought to know is this kind of work, whether it's actual innocence work or the kind of thing with this guy who actually hadn't done anything and got his arrest expunged, it's always a group effort to get things undone. It's very difficult work. It's painstaking work. It's very often heartbreaking work. And in the end, I mean, I took, after we lost in state court for this guy who got his arrest expunged, I took him to federal court, and we actually ended up going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court without any success.
So can you show us what that process looks like for us to know? Because we have a lot of cases that are in different stages of habeas right now, and a lot of balls up in the air, and it gets real confusing. You know, in particular, like we have a case from California right now, our season 12 case, that is it, there's state and federal things happening at the same time. It's really hard. It's hard for me to wrap my brain around exactly what's happening. You know, we've got other cases where it seems like this should be exonerated any day now, and it's been 6-7 years. So it would be great for myself, my audience, to really understand like how the process actually works.
Well, the process works differently from state to state with season 12 Pinyon Pines.
Yes.
So, what a terrific season and what amazing work you did on that. It's a little complicated. I don't know what's going on in federal court there, but state post-conviction litigation in California is called state habeas. I mean, it's called habeas. So,
mm-hmm.
But then there's federal habeas. So normally you don't end up in federal court until you've finished in state court.
Right. And that's what's always confused me about that case, because there's always we're waiting on a ruling on our federal habeas. We're also waiting for a hearing on our state habeas. And it seems like they're happening simultaneously.
Well, so what can happen is there's a statute of limitations, a 1-year statute of limitations on federal habeas petitions. And so what you can do to beat that is if you know what you're going to do in state court, the federal claims you have, you file a petition in federal court and then ask the federal court to stay consideration while you finish up in state court.
Okay.
So that may be what's going on in California and in Pinyon Pines. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. And there's also been a ton of delays there with the wildfires and everything.
But this is a really good way, maybe, for me to talk about how I got involved in Chris Bynum's case.
Okay.
And that is, so Fran Wasson got permission to pursue a second post-conviction petition, mostly on the strength of the Matthews video. And I really hadn't paid much attention to the facts of the case. I'm really, I don't know for your audience, I'm really a technician.
Yeah.
So Chris Bynum had already had one post-conviction petition case with Nathaniel Ruff. He raised the ineffective assistance of Graddick and the suppression and failing to get his statement suppressed. He almost won that. He came very close. If you read the Seventh Circuit opinion in that, they really wanted to do something, but because of the constraints on federal habeas review, they couldn't. So then in 2011, I think it was, a really amazing lawyer up in Gary, a guy named Darnell Lyles, investigated Chris's case and came up with the 4 affidavits that everybody knows about.
Mm-hmm.
And to my way of thinking, this case should have been over then. Darnell applied for, so Chris had already had one post-conviction petition and litigated it. So in Indiana, you only get one.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you request permission to file a successive petition, a second or successive petition. And you have to go to the Indiana Court of Appeals to do that in a non-capital case. In a capital case, you'd go to the Indiana Supreme Court. And for whatever reason, the Court of Appeals, and basically you just file a document. The state doesn't respond. You just file the request. I've never seen the Court of Appeals ask for a response. They either grant permission or deny permission.
Do they need an Indiana? Because I'm very familiar with Texas because I worked so many cases in Texas. In Texas, you get your one bite at the apple and you don't get a second one unless you have new and compelling evidence. Is that a requirement in Indiana, or can you just take another stab at it?
Well, you can take another stab at it. You can't take a stab at anything you've litigated before.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretically, you can take a stab at something that maybe should have been litigated before. I'm actually about to do that in a case.
Yeah.
But it's not new and compelling evidence, actually. So let me get into a brief sort of epicycle here. A lot of times people just talk about the things that are going on, various appeals. What each sort of appeal is very specific to the procedure being used, and there are different standards for each of them. And it doesn't get any easier along the way, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But Indiana has a pretty generous standard for successive petitions. It's not really new and compelling evidence. It's merely you have to show a reasonable probability that if you litigated this issue or additional issues the second time, right, you're in a second petition or a later petition, you have to show a reasonable probability you'd succeed. That's a pretty generous standard. I mean, you said Texas is, you know, compelling evidence.
I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This gets me into how I got into Chris Bynum's case. So
okay.
Fran Watson got permission to file the successive petition, and I was helping her with some editing, but I mean, she'd done all the litigation, but I helped with the editing of a little, some of the written stuff. And, you know, I won't say I was flying along 10,000 feet above her, but I was flying 5,000 feet, not paying a whole lot of attention to the facts. And I was going, I think like a lot of people were, video confession.
Right.
And so what I had agreed to do if she lost in state court was to take Chris's case to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago and ask them for a permission to file a successive federal habeas petition. Chris had already had one federal habeas petition.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, remember I mentioned the generous standard, reasonable probability that you succeed is the standard to get the successive state post-conviction petition filed.
Yeah.
The federal standard is you've got to show not only a constitutional violation, but you've got to show by clear and convincing evidence that you're factually innocent.
Mm-hmm.
That was going to be very hard because, again, the way a case shakes out is incredibly important because, and this is where the technician part of me comes in, the post-conviction trial court, and I think the Court of Appeals in Fran's case, had made an adverse credibility determination on the Matthews video. Yeah, we don't believe it. Federal courts are bound by that credibility determination. I wasn't going to be able to fight that in the Seventh Circuit.
So whatever the finders of the lower, whatever the state court said as far as credibility, they're stuck with that at the federal level.
Absolutely. Unless, I mean, to overturn that, there would have to be something in the record saying that is so wrong. I mean, if the credibility determination in the state courts was so crazy, you just couldn't believe it, then maybe. But after Fran lost, after I looked at it, I started looking at the facts. There was the adverse credibility determination. And I just said, sorry, Fran, we got to go get more.
Yeah.
We just have to. Now, she filed a request for another successive petition based on Larry Brooks's deposition and basically raising the unconstitutional ID and the suggestiveness of the ID. Court of Appeals denied that. And before.
What was their basis for denying that one?
You never know. They just say you haven't shown a reasonable probability of success and you're done. And the other thing is that when the Court of Appeals says that, you can't go to the Indiana Supreme Court to review that decision or to second guess that decision. It's over if the Court of Appeals says no.
And that's it's hard to wrap your brain around that when you have your only material witness saying that he was fake. I mean, you know how frustrating that is, but it's just, some of the times those rulings just drive me crazy.
Well, that's what my students and I did was we cherry picked the crazy, truly what we thought anyway, were the truly crazy state cases and took them to federal court. And we were pretty successful. We won about half our cases in an area of the law where the win rate is less than 0.5%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, you know, it's you get these crazy decisions. They apply the wrong standards. They, you know, one of our cases, the Court of Appeals has said, yeah, an alibi witness wouldn't have made any difference because there was an eyewitness to the crime. No, the alibi, the witness to the crime was the guy who was actually soaked in blood with the victim's mm-hmm. blood, and there was no forensic evidence tying our guy to the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got a hearing in federal court and won that one. And he's out. So Fran got an amazing bunch of lawyers involved. And in the meantime, I had been hooked up by Fran with Nikki Jackson, Dr. Jackson. So I've been on the case about 2.5 years. Dr. Jackson, my guess is it's 6. It might be longer. And I got all the records and I started going through the crime scene photos. And there's a lot of stuff in the crime scene photos that hasn't been talked about. And as it fits together with the evidence list, it's really interesting. The shoes, for instance, out on the ball field, Renee's shoes, the one that was in the middle of the field and the one that was on the path, they aren't on any evidence list.
They didn't even collect them?
I have no idea. They're just not on the list. I mean, wow. Who knows? This is one of the most bizarre investigations I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's the most bizarre one I've ever seen.
Well, that's because you don't have Delphi derangement syndrome yet.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So I spent a lot of time looking at the photos. I think, and it could be completely innocent, I think there's stuff that's been moved around critical stuff that's been moved around in the crime scene photos. I mean, you can tell it's been moved around from the photos.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, bullets show up in different places. At least one bullet shows up in an entirely different place in one photo from another. I don't know that it matters. But
it's also the way they photographically documented it. It's so difficult to piece in. I've never had a case so poorly documented where, you know, like when we had Colin on, he was able to piece together where that drag trail was at. That took a ton of work because the pictures were just so sparse and not done in a way where you could easily piece together the crime scene.
Well, Bertozzi's report, and there's no picture of this, says there is a blood field north. I think it's north of, could be south of, I'd have to check again, of where the bodies were found. There's no picture of that.
Right.
So, I mean, like, that might be an important thing to be able to see.
Or when you take a picture of blood on shingles, maybe take a step back and get a wider shot so you can see where they're at or where, you know, there's all kinds of stuff like that.
By the way, you commented, I noted you commented or asked a question about what that blue thing beside the car was.
Mm-hmm.
25 years later, it's still there.
That's insane.
I was up there last spring or fall a year ago, maybe it was, and it was still there. I have the pictures.
Could you figure out what it is?
It looks like a pillow of some sort. It's hard. It's all broken up and full of leaves now.
Uh-huh.
But it's still there, and it's still pretty much in the same place.
Wow.
It's just closer to a tree as if the wind's blown it. But
mm-hmm.
So anyhow, my role in this is setting this up. Look, when I say setting this up for federal court, people talk about, the great writ of habeas corpus and, you know, the federal courts are not the cavalry. The federal courts are no more sympathetic to criminal defendants than state courts are. And with all of these things, you have to, starting with a direct appeal after a conviction, but then also in a post-conviction case where you go to a trial court and have a hearing, and then the court of appeals, and I'll put a diagram up in just a minute. I'll share a diagram in a minute. There are two things you got to do. You got to make the courts want to grant relief, and then you have to give them a legal way to do it. And in habeas, it's very hard, most often, to give them a legal way to do it. And I think that's what really happened in Chris Bynum's first habeas case, was they wanted to grant him relief, but they couldn't.
What was it? You mentioned earlier that based on the ruling that they wanted to, but they were unable to. What was the hang up there?
That what the state courts had said about the ineffective assistance claim was not unreasonable.
Okay.
And so the standard for habeas relief is if what the state courts did was not an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent, clearly established Supreme Court precedent, or based on an unreasonable determination of the facts, you lose.
Okay.
Courts can't grant relief. And unreasonable has a in terms of the law, it's no fair-minded, basically have to get the federal courts to say that no fair-minded jurist would have come up with this decision.
That none, no one.
That's the standard.
Yeah, it's a tough standard. That would be why that 0.5% success rate exists, probably.
Yeah. Well, the statute of limitations, people are burnt out. There are all kinds of procedural reasons. You raised this issue in your appeal, but you didn't raise it in the Indiana Supreme Court. So you didn't raise it all along the line. So you can't raise it in federal. I mean, there are all kinds of procedural reasons you lose it. Federal habeas is a procedural minefield.
Sure.
And so that's kind of my role in this case is to set, you want to win as early as possible. So what we want, right? I always tell my students there are always four questions. Where are you? So where's Chris Bynum's case? Chris Bynum's case is he's had two state post-conviction petitions and one federal habeas case. What do you want? Obviously, you want his convictions undone. Where do you want to go to get it? Well, you have to go, in this case, to the Indiana Court of Appeals first, because anything we even think about raising later in federal court has to be run through the state courts first. And how are you going to get there? So how you get to the Court of Appeals is, or how you get to a new post-conviction case in the trial court is you have to go through the Indiana Court of Appeals and request permission to file a successive petition. And so we've been busy developing new evidence, putting it together with the old to come up with maybe the Texas standard of a compelling case that he should be allowed to litigate a new state post-conviction petition. If the Court of Appeals says no, then we're back to where I got off the train with Fran's litigation because of the adverse credibility determination. And I'm pretty comfortable now with what we've got going to the Seventh Circuit if we have to, saying, could we please file a successive habeas petition? We were shut out in the state courts.
Are you able to in Indiana within the state court, if you're able to file a successive petition, your first set of issues you raised were denied and you file a successive petition because you've got some new, you know, a new angle you're going to take. Are you able to still kind of stack on the elements from the first one as kind of, you know, we've had cases that I've worked on where it's like, well, this one thing or this one thing or this one thing aren't going to be enough. But if we pile it all on together, then maybe it can make a compelling case. Or is it time barred because it was already argued once and it's dead and it can't be a part of a new petition?
Well, the claim itself a new claim can't really be part of the new petition. But the facts underlying the old claims, take the affidavits. I mean, however many times you litigate this, those affidavits are about facts. They're not about legal issues. And they're going to contribute to the success of whatever you're doing.
Okay, good. See, that is, at least in my understanding, that is where it is different from, like, for example, Texas. So, like, say in Texas, you file a writ based on DNA evidence. The court looks at it. And they say, no, it's not enough, and we deny it. Well, you can't file a successive petition unless you find new. So now you find a new witness, say, and they sign an affidavit. Now you've got new evidence, and you file a second petition with the new evidence. You can't bring in, and also, we have this DNA, because they're looking at it. That was already determined to not be enough, and it's this weird, at least the way I've understood it, that you can't bring that back in as part of this argument.
Well, so then that just opens the door to federal court. You go to the Fifth Circuit, which is not a very friendly circuit, but you go to the Fifth Circuit. You know, if you've got the DNA evidence plus a new witness that show actual innocence, the DNA plus the new witness might be actual innocence by clear and convincing evidence. And that would get you permission to file the successive federal habeas petition. And you wouldn't need state court because the state court said, we don't want to hear it.
Okay, that makes sense.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The system is set up now and has been since 1996 so that you're really supposed to run everything through the state courts first.
Then into federal. So with that kind of the flow we've been talking about, if you want to, you said you had that PDF that kind of showed a flow chart that we can put up.
I can share that. So this is a graphic I threw together for my class. And can you see the cursor?
Yep.
So, you know, the trial court's where somebody gets convicted. That was Chris's trial. Then he had his direct appeal. I think there was a transfer petition. So discretionary review is called something else in every state. You can go to the U.S. Supreme Court after that if there's a federal issue in the appeal. Basically, the U.S. Supreme Court is useless. They grant review in very few cases, and they pretty much have to be exceptional. So once you've finished, so that line is what's called direct review. And then you have, in Indiana, you have post-conviction review, which you file a post-conviction petition raising ineffective assistance, Brady material, newly discovered evidence. And you can file that as of right in the court where you were convicted. And that's called the post-conviction trial court. If you lose there, you go to the Court of Appeals. And if you lose there, you can ask for a review by the Indiana Supreme Court. And again, you can go to the U.S. Supreme Court with a federal issue. And again, they almost never grant review. So once you're finished with that, you've got a year. And I had to spend 2 days. How a year is calculated is Byzantine. I'm not going to go into it, but I'd have to spend I spent two full days with my students showing them how you calculate what a year is. And so you've got a year to file a federal habeas petition, and you file that in the district court. District court rules, you lose there. You go to the Seventh Circuit. Now, you don't get to go to the Seventh Circuit as of right. You have to get what's known as a certificate of appealability. And basically, the issue has to be something more than frivolous in order to get the appeal. In order to be permitted to take the appeal. And after the Seventh Circuit, there's the Supreme Court. So what happens now is, with Chris, he's already been through row one. So he did that. He's been through row two twice, and he's been through row three once. So what he has to do now is he has to apply here.
Back at the federal level?
No, this is back in the middle row.
Back at the state level.
Back in the middle row, the post-conviction appeal, that's where the Court of Appeals is.
Okay.
And so apply to the Court of Appeals for permission to go back down to the post-conviction trial court with new claims and new evidence. If they grant it, he does that, and you just do row three again. That in the middle of row three, they deny permission for successive petition. Because he's already had a habeas petition, he can't just file in the district court. He has to file for permission in the Seventh Circuit for permission to file in the district court, which they can grant or deny. Again, there's no review by the U.S. Supreme Court of that decision. And so we're really focused on these, the middle two stages of lines two and three.
And this is really useful to even, you know, I've spent the last 10 years working in post-conviction stuff, and I always get confused by this process a lot. One, I always used to think of, you know, in the top line, which the top line, the direct appeal, or usually like constitutional issues, errors in the trial, right?
Right.
Is that correct? Yeah. So they, you file a direct appeal, If that doesn't work, then you go to a federal. Is the discretionary review, is that the state Supreme Court?
That's the state Supreme Court. Yeah.
Yep. And then if that gets denied, you can then appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court. To me, that always meant that's your federal appeal. But there's a whole, the U.S. Supreme Court is kind of the end of every row, but there's a different process for what we think of as like a federal habeas. And that's when you move down to the next, the post-conviction, which then goes to state, right? And then to the state Supreme Court, and then it can go to federal. Is that the discretionary review in line two? Is that a federal court?
No, the discretionary review, that's again, is the state Supreme Court.
Okay, then to the U.S. Supreme Court again, and then the last line is where we go into a federal habeas.
Right.
So that federal, so that in Indiana is District 7, in Texas, I think, is what, District 5, but the federal district court, so that is different than just being sent to the Supreme Court. You're going into the federal district courts that will then work their way up to. I feel like in the last year, after the last presidential election, we've heard more and more about federal district court judges than I think I've ever heard in my whole life. So I'm starting to get a little better grasp on it.
Well, what I will say is, so we really want a successive state post-conviction petition, permission to file a successive. Granted, we've got a few claims so that we can go back here and do it again. You want to do it, you know, you want to get into this system as early as possible. And, you know, you don't want to have to go to the Seventh Circuit and ask for permission there, because remember, the standard there is you got to show by clear and convincing evidence actual innocence. I think we can do that, but that doesn't mean I want to do that, right?
Right.
So what happens, though, if we do have to do that, is by statute, the Seventh Circuit only has 30 days to decide whether to grant permission to file a successive habeas petition. And if you make a prima facie case, and I'm pretty comfortable with that, what they do is they send it back to the district court to duke it out with the attorney general about whether you have, in fact, shown actual innocence by clear and convincing evidence.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you want to like get it into that middle step there, which is asking for the successive petition as early as possible. But is it true? I assume with most legal teams in most states, it would be the same. There's always the frustrating part from us non-lawyers who are like, well, let's get it going. But then there's also the fact that because it's so difficult to get that approval. In a lot of cases I've worked, it's like we're waiting and waiting and waiting. Sometimes it goes on for years as they're trying to fully develop the case because they may not get another chance. So they want to make sure they get everything in there all at once. Does that framework kind of play into this too, where you want to get it in there soon, but you don't want to try it too early when you have other elements of the case that you could add to that petition?
Well, that's right. That's right. And I love the podcast about Leon Benson's case. Lara, oh God, I'm blocking on her name, out in San Francisco. Anyway, Leon Benson was somebody she exonerated in Indiana. She had a podcast series on him, and they got the critical piece of evidence. And then she said, that's not enough, and kept going. And I just, you know, that made me feel so much better about the approach I'd taken in Chris's case. I mean, taking Chris's case to the Seventh Circuit after Fran lost would really have been pointless,
mm-hmm.
just because of the adverse credibility determination. But yeah, I mean, you obviously want, again, the standard in Indiana is not the same as Texas, you know, compelling evidence, but you do want to be compelling, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, and that's part of our season three case right now has been going. That was the one where Jesse Eldridge's case, where, you know, he was convicted in a really short bench trial with exactly one piece of evidence against him. And that was his brother's testimony. His brother recanted. And, you know, we all thought like right away. But now in that case, there's a conviction integrity unit involved as well. So we're kind of working on their timeline. But at the same time, there was also DNA testing out being done. And it's so hard to get those petitions in front of court. They're like, well, we don't want to just go with the confession. We want to go with, let's see what these DNA results are first before we can stack that on top of it and make this a bigger and more compelling case. And the frustrating part is, you know, it's been 6 years.
Well, I mean, in an ideal world, the Lee County prosecutor would join us in either something in the court of, probably join us in a request for a successive petition in the Court of Appeals. There are a couple different ways that could be run, but that, and you know, if he were to do that, then, you know, Court of Appeals would almost certainly grant it. And then we'd be back in the post-conviction court and, you know, Chris would be out on a joint motion or something. You know, they're looking at a bunch of evidence. There's one thing I would really like them to do, hope they'll do in a hurry. I don't think it's difficult, and that is run those two fingerprints from the car through APHIS.
Yeah.
I mean, that should be overnight.
Yeah, that should have been done on day one originally.
Yeah, I don't know in what world you just compare the fingerprints to Chris Bynum and the victims.
Yeah, is when you've decided Chris Bynum's your guy and you don't want any bad evidence.
You know, there are a lot of inferences to be made. I try to assume good faith on Hanlon's razor. Don't ascribe to malice that which can be adequately explained by negligence or incompetence. I don't know. This is a huge investigation. I mean, there are obviously lots of people involved. There are lots of people all over that crime scene. I don't know how, I mean, I think I must have sent it to you. I don't know how. So it looked like Bertossi was the one who was looking at the car and the Lake County Sheriff's Department's garage. And I don't know how they missed that the ignition switch is busted.
Yeah. It's never mentioned in any report.
It isn't. And, you know, you put that together with, you know, the evidence Fran developed of a steering wheel club, a lock that was in there. And by the way, the steering wheel club was never found, nor was there ever found a screwdriver or anything that would have been used to start the car.
Mm-hmm.
So the investigation, I do know that at the beginning, well, to start with, I mean, to go back to Graddick, you know, I don't really know what he did or didn't do, but I have never seen a docket like this one. I mean, the docket is a page and a half in a quintuple murder, the trial docket.
Yeah. And usually it'd be 20, 30. I mean, the ones that I've looked at in the past, they just go on and on and on forever.
Yeah.
Real quick, I want to wrap this up before too long, but can you explain to listeners what we mean by the docket?
It's the list of everything that's filed in the case, the setting of hearings, the motions, the, you
know, request for discovery, everything like that.
Discovery notices from the prosecution saying we turned X, Y, and Z over today.
Yeah. And so usually you can imagine the time leading up to a trial. Usually there's just, you know, there's a litany of items on a docket. So yeah, you said it. What did you say? It's only just a page and a half.
It's a page and a half. I can send it to you. You can put it up on the.
We can put it up on the case docs. And with that being said, at the beginning of this episode, I said this was going to be the first episode of season 18. But I think we've talked enough about Chris's case. This will be season 17, episode 24. Because I want to keep this together with some of the other information we had before we wrap things up, Michael. I did have a question from Teresa, one of our patrons in the chat. She wanted to know, could you tell us how many convictions have been overturned because of you and your students' work?
I think it's 7. So we've undone basically 500 sentencing years. We've had one outright exoneration. Again, you know, we never took these cases because the people were innocent. Some of our clients were innocent. I mean, I find myself talking to people who say they're innocent all the time, and they well may be, but procedurally, I can't do anything for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's 7 overturned convictions, and you said you did that. You worked there for 10 years.
Yeah, we kind of got started after about the second of the 10, so 8. But you know, we also had 0 resources. It was just, I mean, literally 0 resources. This was just my students, me, and our machines.
Well, that's incredible work. I'm excited to see what else comes of Chris's case and learn more about it as the case hopefully starts to move back into the courts here sometime soon. And just to kind of to prep everybody for this, Michael does have, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, some connection to the work that's been done on the Richard Allen case, the Delphi case. And we talked before we went on the air today, and at some point here in the near future, I know everybody, that's one of the cases that everybody, whenever we're like, oh, we're going to take a break from our case and talk about some other stuff, everybody wants to know what's going on. There's a ton going on in that case right now with all of the appeals. Michael has told me that he knows Andrea. We mentioned Andrea Burkhardt. He knows Andrea. So we're going to try to get Michael to maybe pitch Andrea. And I'm going to have, ideally, we're going to try to have Michael and Andrea on together to update everybody on what's going on and with that case and where it might be going from here. And so that's going to be coming up soon. And with that being said, Michael, thanks so much for taking the time out of your evening to join us and share all that knowledge with us.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. I hope it's been helpful.
It certainly has. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kate Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.